Have you ever marveled at how some people are always working on deals and they always have an exciting opportunity they're involved with? If you're like me, I'm amazed at how some people have a unique gift to create opportunities from just an idea. In today's interview, you are in for a treat. You will be introduced to a deal maker. Welcome to the Raising and Capital interview series. I'm your host, Russell Westcott from the Real Estate Investment Network, your one-stop shop for all things investment real estate. The intention of this interview series will be to help solve your biggest challenge, and that's where to find the money to invest in real estate. Tonight, I'm going to introduce you to a top real estate deal maker, someone who invests in real estate with investors and does so with very little of his own capital in the deal. Our special guest is Mr. Richard Dolan, and he is going to challenge you to think bigger. Richard is the author of 12 books and has delivered over 2,000 presentations, sharing the stage with some of the biggest names in the personal and professional development industry. Richard, with all that you have going on, for you to take time out of your schedule is very much appreciated. Welcome to the call. How are you doing today, Rich?
Well, I'm doing well, Russ. I'm doing well. You know, every time that you're on the move and connecting lots of dots, there's lots of movement, which can be exhausting and cumbersome at times. But at the end of the day, if you're not moving, you're dying. So it's great to be here. It's great to be vertical, at least.
Absolutely. And we're glad to have you on the call. So today's call is all about making the deals and pitching the deals and how do you get your ideas across to people. Before we get into all the detail of the agenda, for the people that are listening to this interview that maybe haven't heard of the name Richard Dolan, can you give us a quick snapshot of who you are and what brought you to this point and why we should be listening to you?
Well, sure. You know, I've been, I'm born and raised in Toronto, and I am Canadian. I live and reside in Toronto currently. And for 20 years, I was really brought up in the space of the financial services arena. So from 1991 till this particular day, I've really grown to become a wealth management real estate investor guy. I was groomed and taught and trained by, I have to say, some of the world's most successful asset gatherers and venture capitalists money could ever find. And I've been pretty privileged at being able to be trained and taught and educated by some of their great mentors and teachers. So those greats that I got mentored by, in fact, ensured that I got trained and equipped as they did. Because as I worked with them, I needed to have the right equipment and wherewithal to assist them in what it was that they were doing. So I sit here as a constant student in the art of deal making. I always remain an incredibly engaged spectator of the sport, eager to learn the tips of the trade so that I can head onto the field and put in play the very moves I see from the stands and from the advantage points that I've gotten. So today, I'm an educator. I love research. I appreciate analysis. I appreciate more generating results from learning and knowing the things that I've learned and know in the space of real estate. And I love connecting with people, especially making new relationships, really developing new intellectual property and developing new partnerships through collaboration to bring to life the magic and power of what I've learned in the two decades inside the game currently called real estate. That's who I am. That's what I'm doing.
Awesome. Awesome. So you mentioned that you have a background in the financial services industry. Mm-hmm. So how much experience do you have yourself personally with raising capital, financially, financial services, and also on the real estate side? If you can give us a little bit of the scope that we're talking about.
Wonderful. Absolutely. Well, you know, my experience is a two-sided coin. The one side is the wealth management and having been trained and become effective in raising capital. And the other side of the coin is really in the application of that skill set inside the realm of real estate. So let me deal with the first one. In raising capital, I was trained as a financial advisor's business development guy. I was built to go out there and find where the assets are, understand the face of what money looks like, really build a nose, if it were, for where the dough was in the country. And I was equipped with the skill sets, the life skills and the personal skills and the intellectual skills and the emotional skills to really go after that market with confidence, with charisma, and even with absolute conviction. So in the space of wealth management, where whether I was selling mutual funds or placement funds or limited partnerships or investment scenarios, as in plans or strategies, you know, I wasn't going after just middle of the road kind of folks. I was built to go and look for high net worth, or what's also called as elite net worth. So people who had $1 million or $100 million. And so that takes a very special skill set that I had to be groomed for and built for. So once you go into the space of raising millions of dollars, I've worked with several companies over the 15 years in the financial services business, and about $7 billion later, I can look back and say that I've raised money from people who had only $5,000 to invest to $50 million to invest. And creating that bandwidth of expertise has allowed me to understand and appreciate that really, no matter how many zeros are on the end of a check that you're collecting, people are people, and human beings are just simple human beings. And what makes it complex isn't who they are, it's what you make who they are. And that's kind of what brings me to the second side of the coin, which is real estate. I appreciate that there's a simplicity about real estate, and that's kind of why I got into real estate in a very big way, in a very institutional way, in and around 2005. So having made a lot of money in the financial services business with a lot of luck and great timing, I entered the real estate market recognizing that there was a growing need for access points and institutional product in that space. So I saw a marketing opportunity and I took it and began working with institutions around that space. And so having raised millions of dollars in that space for syndicated product, for offering memorandums and such, having done that as an issuer myself, I've seen the regulation side, I've seen the security side. It's not a pretty side of that market, let me tell you. I just started to gain a deeper appreciation for saying, hey, regulation and securitization has its place in real estate, but not for me. I want to really get down to its purest essence. And that's kind of why I picked up Don's book, read it cover to cover, and realized, you know what, let me simplify my life as an investor by becoming a real estate investment business owner. And that's been the new rendition of my career and my path with real estate. That's how I married who I've been and what I've become.
Wow. So needless to say, you've raised a little bit of capital in your case of doing that. So we are truly talking with an expert and a deal maker. Now, speaking of deal makers, you've shared many different examples on stage or in person of our of talking. Can you just share maybe an example with the listeners of where you've created a business opportunity from just an idea that you had?
Well, you know, I take, for example, the fact that when I and my business partner, who many of you might know as counsel, David Franklin, when we began advising firms and developers in about 2008 in around the international space, you know, we were working with a project out of Anguilla. We were then working with projects out of Mexico and, of course, in Europe and Central America, even Panama. And out of that, we began to really gain an appreciation for how complex the cross-border issues are from Canada to some of these countries. And we were pretty mesmerized by not just the barriers of language, but just by the sheer fact of their laws or even sometimes the absence of them. But then 2008 happened, the big global correction, the financial fiasco, this big market meltdown. And out of that emerged this buying opportunity of a lifetime in the U.S. And as a result, even though we wrote a book on international real estate called Life Rich Real Estate, even though Harvard calls it the greatest science on optimally matching people with place, and we can really go off on a tangent about that, we realized that at the seminars we were doing, a lot of people, although were interested in international real estate, kept asking about the U.S. And out of that request, time and time again, we recognized that there was a void. And so as the old saying goes, you know, find a need, fill a need. And so we did. And so as a result of a lot of people just asking the same question, we were listening in a way to say, hey, we found a need. Let's fill a need. So we launched the U.S. Property Shop, which we've called Canada's one-stop shop for all things U.S. real estate. Said it was Canadian-based and Canadian-owned, which it is. And to this day, we now applaud the efforts of our team for having presented the U.S. Property Shop Advantage to over 5,000 Canadians from coast to coast, presenting well over $1 billion now worth of U.S. residential real estate since its inception. And by the way, it was just an idea. So we're really glad that we had the depths and the ability and the skill set to brand and position and articulate the service. But at the end of the day, we're just real estate investors that recognize that there was a need for more information on the U.S. And as a result, we, well, looked at that need and we filled the need. And that would probably be a great example.
Wow. So you literally just saw an opportunity, structured it, put systems in place, put the team in place, and is now placed over $1 billion Is it close to a billion, you said?
Well, it's about $1 billion that we presented to Canadians coast to coast. So as of about now, that's where we're at. And I got to just continue with one last little metaphor. You know, anyone can really sell, for example, U.S. residential real estate or any real estate for that matter. But, you know, there's something to be said about the fact that, you know, it's like buying a gift for someone. If you and I, Russ, were to give a wedding gift to a couple we knew, let's say this upcoming Saturday, well, you can buy the same vase and I can buy the same vase, but sometimes people aren't so concerned about what is inside the box as much as they are concerned with what it looks like from outside the box. So if I wrapped it with incredible bows and silk ribbons and an incredible chic gold lacquered type wrapping versus maybe your $2.95 roll of paper, I'm not suggesting that you've got to spend a lot of money on the wrapping in order to give someone a gift. But what I am saying is that sometimes the better gift wrap product ends up getting them more attention. And that's what ends up happening for us. Lots of people have been doing U.S. residential real estate for quite some time. We got a lot of attention because of the way we packaged it. And that's the genius inside of, and probably one of the big secrets that you'll learn when you come to the workshop coming up soon.
Wow, so you really have said that you presented better than most other people out there.
That's exactly it. And it's really from listening from the perspective of what is missing and what is needed, not what we think we like to do and how we like to perform it, but just really keeping it simple. Find the need, fill the need.
Well, I'll tell you what, looking through the detailed long list of your bio, it literally is a who's who list of professional athletes and actors and business people. You know, you've been on the stage with certain presidents of the United States, George W. Bush, Bill Clinton, Tony Robbins. How were you able to get yourself on the stage with those people?
I think even a better question, if you were to ask it differently, would be, you know, why did I share the stage with those big names? Because the why really produced the how. And I think for a lot of people, when they see those pictures and whatnot, you know, I take a lot of pride, not so much in having had the honor, because of course I do have the honor of always and forever having the right to say I've spoken alongside the likes of some of those iconic thinkers and innovators and leaders in this world in our lifetime. But what was more interesting was just the why. And the why for me was quite simple. I remember having to say to myself, you know, what am I doing to build really my credibility? What am I doing to establish myself as a brand? You know, what kind of collaterals do I have to show for myself? You know, I've written a lot of things, and I know you've covered that, and I've been with a lot of people, and I've raised a lot of money, but so what? You know, people often forget what they hear. They often remember mostly what they see. So if I had images of having worked with some of the world's greatest leaders and thinkers, they're not going to see me. They're going to see me with other people they recognize. You know, it's often saying, well, hey, I recognize that guy, but who's this guy? And so out of that why, out of the need to create collaterals that supported my mission to go out there and be a leader in the space of real estate education, I felt it was important for me to really kind of start to swim with the bigger sharks. And so the how showed up by way of being clear as to how important it was, the why. And so how I was able to do that was naturally nearly impossible by any stretch of the imagination to do it simply. But it came with finding out where these people were going to be, getting involved with the organizers in a great way, and offering them some value that these organizers would find irreplaceable and undisputably of value. And providing it. What was the value? Well, of course, on a different case-by-case basis, I can't go into each and every one of them, but I created value. And as a result, as the old adage goes, the hand that gives gathers. And so, you know, producing value for whether they were charitable organizations or, event organizers or promoters who had big ticket names coming to town, I connected with those people in the way that I know I can. I offered some great value add, which they couldn't refuse. And in exchange, I received value, which would have either included just meeting some great, wonderful people to actually performing alongside. And a footnote to that, There's more power in being able to perform on stage with those people than it is just to appear with them. Because I've got to admit, anyone can take a picture with a celebrity, but having worked with one is the kind of bragging right I wanted. So there's a bit of a difference. The wonderful pictures that I've got is largely because I did some work with them in some capacity. I've since then been invited to dinners and events, and I've been able to eat alongside some incredible people, but I've refused to take pictures with them only because I felt for myself I didn't want to have just pictures with people. I wanted pictures with famous people only if I got a chance to work with them. So that's a great way of elevating your bar and living up to the standard that you set for yourself. So that's how I got that, and that's how it was important it was for me, yeah.
That is, you know, it literally is a who's who's list. So if people have seen you on stage and watch you present, you are a extremely gifted and polished presenter. Mm-hmm. Is that skill set something very helpful to raising capital?
Absolutely, without question. You know, I have to tell you, I've over the years, it took me a long time to come to grips with the idea of being called slick, smooth. In fact, I actually was very hurt by getting those comments from people. And, you know, it took me a long time to really actually begin to appreciate and learn that maybe slick wasn't always that bad. Maybe smooth wasn't always that bad. But I needed to be responsible for how slick and smooth I was. And producing a polished presentation came out of a massive appreciation for how I really respect and appreciate impeccability. You know, I find it very odd that, you know, people go to the movie theater and watch a movie, and very rarely will you ever hear someone say, well, wow, that was a slick movie. They should call it a slick movie. Think of your favorite film, Russ. What would be your favorite film? What would you say?
Well, just recently saw The Avengers.
Oh, now there's a slick movie, right?
Exactly.
Like, that's an impeccable movie. Cost them $200 million to build. But did you walk out of the theater and said to your wife, hey, that was a slick movie, yes or no?
No, I just said I was thoroughly entertained.
Right, but oddly enough, it's pretty slick.
Yes,
so,
it was.
But if I went on stage and I told you the story about the Avengers with the kind of PowerPoints I build and with the kind of animation I do and with the kind of preparation I got, you might walk away saying, geez, that was pretty slick.
Like.
Now, the reason why you'd say that about a presenter, but you wouldn't say that about a movie, is because people see a personality. And so what you begin to learn is that presenting has a personality. And then you really start digging deep is that that personality is all about an entertainment value. And so when you start to really appreciate the entertainment value of being a presenter, you start to really work with and be at home with the idea of moving and motivating and inspiring people in a way that has nothing to do with how you appear, it has nothing to do with how you sound, but has everything to do with the results you produce. So for me, being polished or being gifted, without doubt I'm gifted. I just used those gifts in a way that I was able to harness them inside this art or a game called presenting. The question becomes for people who understand that presenting yourself is a massive tool, no different from writing emails, no different from shaking a hand, no different from building the deal, and no different from performing cash flow analysis and presenting even that. Presenting yourself and the ideas you have is a skill set that is undisputably the champion for getting a deal done. If people don't like you, if they don't have a part of themselves that likes or respects a part of you, if they don't have a piece of envy for what you do or respect for how you've done it, chances are quite high they'll want little to do with you.
Wow.
Because people average up their experience in the world. They don't look like, hey, can't wait to wake up tomorrow morning and find a loser to hang out with. No offense to losers, but there's no book that says how to masterfully lose in life. You know, no one's buying that book off the bookshelves. People want to average up their experience in life. So presenting yourself is the place, the first place people get a sense of who you are and the kind of experience they can have with you. If you make that a magical one, then the rest becomes a little bit easier than harder.
Wow. So you just mentioned the term of presenting yourself, and I wrote that down, and by all means, everyone should have a pen and paper. Some people listening to this interview will, when you heard the word presenting or pitch or presenting yourself, they've got that nervous knot in their stomach and they just absolutely got petrified about that.
Sure.
What would you say to somebody who is really scared and terrified about presenting in front of people?
Well, you know, my first answer is this. You've got to get over it. You can't take yourself that seriously. You really can't. What's interesting is that it's been said that if you don't have fear, then you're not going to perform. Even I right now, you know, I get stage fright. Believe it or not, Russ, you and I have shared enough stages to, you got close enough to me to get. I don't know if you noticed, but I actually do have stage fright.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important for me to have that because I know that it keeps a part of me with the edge. if I take myself not seriously enough, then guess what ends up happening? I'm going to end up performing very poorly. But to backtrack a little, you know, there was a book once written about everything you needed to know about fear. And it was well over 400 pages long, very thick. And the introduction read this. It was a very short one. If you want to get this book without having to read it, then accept this and bypass all the reading. And that is that whatever you fear, you must accept. Because whatever you fear, you will expect. And whatever you expect, you will experience. So you think about that for a second. If whatever I fear, I will expect, and whatever I expect, I will experience, the reality is this, then what am I expecting? If I expect to be judged and criticized and ridiculed, then that's what you're going to get. If you expect to be loved and respected and admired, even perhaps, well, downright attracted to, as in money and raising it, then that's what you'll get. So whatever you fear, you will expect, and whatever you expect, you will experience. The challenge for people who are petrified of presenting is they have no control over what they fear. Without having control over what you fear, you have no control over what you can expect. And without having control over what you expect, you have no control over what you will experience. So when you think that through, that is the most fundamental part of presenting yourself. It's not about presenting. Because look, Russ, you and I are presenting right now, right? We're talking to each other on a phone.
Absolutely.
And for everyone that's listening to this interview, you talk to people every day. You go to the bank, you talk to the teller, you interact with clients and customers, staff or employees, coworkers and such. You go put gas in, you interact with the gas attendant. You countlessly and effortlessly present yourself. You present your case to pay less. You present your case to ask for something to be served to you. You present your case to get your steak better done. You're always presenting. Why aren't you fearful? Because you're not associating any expectation to what it is you're saying. But the moment you have to present what you must say, what comes with it is what you hope others will experience. And once you put that into your mind, it produces a fear. So whatever you fear, you will expect. Whatever you expect, you will experience. What do you want their experience to be should produce the result you want to produce, and that will diminish, if not annihilate, your fear. So am I a perfect presenter? No. Are there better than me? Absolutely. Are there other presenters that can speak clearer and impeccably and probably even more passionately? Absolutely. But I will tell you one thing I do have, and that is I have a fearlessness, which is also known as a prowess, around speaking. Why? Because I'm at home and at peace with when I speak. I have no fear in what I expect, and therefore what I'm experiencing is just the act of speaking. No different from what I'm doing right now on this phone call with you, Russ. And I think that's important for people to take home.
Absolutely. I had one of my early mentors in speaking came to me, and I was all nervous and all bottled up and things. He goes, why are you so nervous? This has nothing to do with you. It has all 100% to do with the audience. Give them everything you got, because it has nothing to do with you. And if you give them everything you got, there's no way you can fail.
Well said, and that was actually sage wisdom.
Yeah. So what are some of the biggest mistakes you see that when people are trying to present their ideas or present a deal to somebody? What's some of the biggest mistakes you see people do?
Well, you know, that's a real charged question. You know, the biggest mistakes that I've seen when someone is presenting their ideas and looking to raise money is that they don't keep things simple. You know, we keep things in a very complicated format, and you know, it's one of the most charged conversations you can have besides someone's health and or life. So doctors have a very large task of dealing with their patients when it comes to illness and wellness and taking care of oneself. The next biggest, most sensitive topic is someone's money. So people parting with their money is no easy feat, unless of course they're spending it at a casino or perhaps putting it all on red. But the reality is that the mistakes that often people do when it comes to presenting their ideas and looking to raise money is that they really overcomplicate things. So you've really got to consider that you've got to keep it simple, the KISS principle, right? Keeping things simple is very, very important. Complicating it, over-legalizing it, over-analyzing it are all deep holes that we often trip into because we think that more is better, and it's not true. Less is more. And at the end of the day, you've got to simply understand and appreciate one thing. People aren't listening to your idea because it's great, and people aren't going to invest with you because they're just going to be making money. People invest with you, and money will be drawn to you because they trust you. If they don't trust you, then you won't. It won't matter how great your idea is, and it won't matter how much money you raise. And I've made that tragic error many, many times. I can produce wonderful packages, great brands, and awesome case studies, but it won't matter because if the person doesn't trust me, then it won't matter. You know, Nick Murray once said that people don't care what you know until they know that you care. So a great way to really get to that, to building trust, is to understand first why are the people that you're going to raise money are listening to you. What's in it for them that you know of or you should know or be aware of that is important to them? Is it about financial freedom? Is it about a rate of return? And if so, how much? Or is it a preservation of capital? But until you know, and they know you do, they won't care how great the idea is. And chances are, you won't attract the money that you came to raise.
Interesting. In this interview series, I've interviewed two lawyers, a mortgage broker, accountants, and other experts. And simple, organized, and easy to understand has come through on all of the interviews that I've talked to people with. So
good to hear.
It's a universal truth.
It is. Keeping it simple, because over-trivializing things only makes work for you. And I'll tell you something, for you listeners listening to this, if you're one of those people who like to over-trivialize, it's another way of you avoiding the conversation called raising money. So when we make things complicated, what it allows us to do is bury ourselves in a work that has us be in a state of preparation. But if you're always in a constant state of preparation, you're never going to actually jump onto the field and actually make a play. If you're always in training, then you're never going to be playing the sport. If you're always learning on how to build the perfect deal but aren't raising money for it, then what's the point?
Yep. I remember when I closed my first investor partner, I was living in a basement suite. I had never bought a piece of real estate. And this gentleman had $1 million in net worth and had bought many houses. And I presented my deal, and it was a terrible presentation. Mm-hmm. And I was so nervous. And at the end of it, he put up $30,000. And I asked him years later why he put the money with me. And he had clearly said, he goes, Russ, I saw your passion and your commitment to make this work, and I wanted a part of that. Mm. And that was it. I got my first deal with passion and commitment.
I got to tell you.
I didn't know what I was doing.
you're bingo bang on. You know, I've got to tell you, one of some of the most powerful fundraisers in the world that I've ever had the privilege of meeting and or being introduced to or having worked with, if there's one thing they were, was electric. You know, passionate about what they were doing, on fire about their idea. Russ, I couldn't agree with you more.
Yep. So you're, you know, there's a dating term here. Your Rolodex, or let's put it this way, your BlackBerry is, as I mentioned, is a who's who of phone numbers in there. Obviously, you've had to have been introduced to them or been put in the same situation or same place as they are. How did you break the ice with a President Clinton or one of these people? How do you break the ice with somebody that you want to meet?
Well, you know, what's interesting is that you've got to first and foremost understand that, again, back as to what I said earlier on, is that no one wants a charity case. You know, especially those with money, they don't want to necessarily take you on as their newfound cause. You know, at the end of the day, whether you are mildly successful, very successful, or ultra successful, people are drawn to work with those that they really actually trust and like. So the question really becomes, what are you doing to produce trustworthiness, and what are you doing to produce likability? You know, this is not about financial intelligence. This is more about social intelligence. You know, I'll share with you a real quick story. It's a true one. It just came out of this past week. As you know, Russ, I was in Miami just recently meeting with a couple of clients. And what was interesting about this conversation was, you know, we have a client who produces the world's fastest car, a supercar named Pagani. They produce the Zonda R. And they have a client who represents them in Miami, a car dealer. And you can only imagine that if you're a car dealer of a supercar, that, you know, the starting price is 1.7 million euro. The dealer also deals in Lamborghinis and Bentleys and Rolls Royces. If you're selling those kind of cars, you know rich people, correct?
Absolutely.
It would go without saying. Yeah. So here I am hanging out with this dealer. We're just having a chit-chat, and a client walks in. And as he walked in, you know, he started just chit-chatting with the dealer over an issue. Well, I asked if I can excuse myself, and the client said, no, I don't mean to interrupt. I want you to sit here because maybe you can help me with my problem. I said, sure. So as he's chatting about a challenge he had in his business, he's just talking openly. I gave, you know, my 2 cents after, of course, the dealer gave his and my client from Italy gave his. I said, well, have you ever considered this? He goes, you know what, that's a great idea. I said, wonderful, you should try it. He goes, have you ever tried that before? And it doesn't matter what the idea was. The point is that I was engaged in a conversation. Well, it turned out that that person I was actually talking to turns out to be a producer of a very famous Hollywood blockbuster film, which is filming their third installment this summer. And if I were to tell you the name, and it starts with a T, ends with an S, I can't tell you because I'm sworn to secrecy, but it's an absolute multi-million dollar enterprise. What's the moral of the story? Three things comes to mind. Number one is if you're trusted and likable, you're going to be able to open up doors. It also allows you to stay inside the rooms in which those doors belong to. But most of all, you're invited back. When you're able to produce trust and likability, this is all about growing your social intelligence. Introductions follow. Now, an accelerator of that is understanding that when you're there as a stand to create value for people, then you get referrals. You know, as you know, Russ, I work with the Miami Heat as another one of my clients, and they are always sending me referrals to the higher-ups of brands like Hublot, Rolex, Bacardi. Why? Because those clients of theirs are looking for a little bit of insight on some business development measures that they need some advice on. And so when those conversations happen with the Miami Heat, the Miami Heat say, you know what, we don't know the answer to that, but we have a friend of the firm who would absolutely be more than happy to help you. Now, the Miami Heat organization appreciates that because we're creating a value add for their client base. They have 219 sponsors. I appreciate the introduction because it opens up another door. But the reason why it does is because they know they can count on one thing, and this is the takeaway lesson, is that I'm going to create a value add. I will listen to the challenge, I will hear it out completely, and I will suggest some ideas and insight. And out of that, they'll either going to take it, like it, use it, or dump it. But either way, they know they got the best. Why? Because they were referred to me.
And either way, you added something, whether they used it or didn't, you provided something to them.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. So establishing likability and trustworthiness, I made sure I wrote those terms down. So imagine I have 30 seconds and I've met somebody. Is there some things that I can do in 30 seconds to get the ball rolling with those things?
Well, boy, that's another loaded question. You know, it's sort of like, you know, if I wanted to find the perfect mate and only had 30 seconds to make my case, what would I say? Boy, that's a lot of pressure in 30 seconds. But, you know, for myself personally, if someone were to be filming me while I was about to meet a very important contact for the first time, or I was going to try and open up the door for the first time, and if they were to just stop, freeze, frame that moment, so they were breaking it down frame by frame for those 30 seconds, you'd probably pick out three things that I was going to do impeccably well, and because I have an absolute honor for and respect to that initial 30 seconds. What you'd probably see is that I am greeting that person with my entire soul. Like when I say hello to that person that's impeccably important to that introduction, they know that I'm absolutely 100% honored to meet them. They're absolutely clear I feel honored to meet them. You know, I'm not just holding their hand, I'm holding their arm. Like it's almost like, you know, thanks for rescuing me from that pit. Thanks for pulling me back from that edge. Like there's a massive sense of gratuity and gratefulness and humbleness with that person. That's important because what you're producing is humility. Number two is if you were to watch that, you know, that frame by frame of the 30 seconds of me meeting someone for the first time, you probably see there's an absolute unwavering eye lock. You know, I'm not looking around. I'm not distracted by my phone. And it buzzes all the time, which is why largely it's only on vibrate. There's nothing that distracts me. And for that short period of time, that's all they know is that they're the only pair of eyes that matter in that particular moment. So there's a massive amount of presence. So the first is humility. The second is presence. Like I'm really present to them. The third is that I'm absolutely articulate. about who I am, what I do, and what I'd like to do with them. Articulate introductions produces confidence. Confidence creates conviction, and conviction produces comfort. So if I'm able to create humility, if I'm able to produce a massive amount of presence, like being present, and that then leads to being comfortable, I got myself a very magical 30 seconds. And at least I'm off to a good start.
Wow.
And I've got to say that even though I may not continue to do business with those people, one thing I am is unforgettable. And not because of what I said and not because of what I did, but because of how I left those people feeling. And that is what I want you as a listener to get from that particular point.
Wow. And I tell you, that leads right into the next question that you've talked many, many times about. People always say they should be out there and they should network and they should network and they should network. And you're forget networking, connect, connect, connect. What do you mean by, what's the difference in your world between networking and connecting?
Well, you know, I just mentioned it in terms of freeze framing the 30 seconds when you meet someone, what you'd see if you were to watch me under close observation when I'm meeting someone that's important to me for the first time. And I think most of the people who are listening to this particular phone call who've met me for the first time, some of you even said to me, boy, I remember when you first met me, I really was thrown back by just how present you were with me or how you really acknowledged me. And that's just who I am. It's not just something I switch on like it's an act. It's just really who I am. But I think what's important for me to share with this juncture is, you know, where I really gained an appreciation, not where I learned it first, but I gained an appreciation for it was when I actually had a chance to tour with President William Jefferson Clinton. I remember this particular moment where I was backstage, and it was actually in Calgary, and we're at the Calgary TELUS Convention Center. And as we stood back there, I remember I'd actually really had to haul butt to get there on time. And so I was, of course, just completely out of breath and a little bit tainted by the way of I thought I was not going to even make it. Needless to say, I was at the back, and he was very calm. And what I noticed was as I stood there right in front of him, it was 100 things going on at the same time all around us. But the only thing that mattered to him was the conversation we were in. He went on to share with me a story of him in Ireland and where nobility was hosting him during a dinner. And as he was going through this story, I almost forgot some of the details because what I was actually admiring wasn't the fact he was sharing the story, but the fact that he was absolutely in my space. The guy was just, like President Clinton was just, it was just he and I. Even though there were guards and there was Secret Service and there was the host and other people, we were having a conversation. And so in that moment, I really felt it mattered for him to connect. Now, I thought this was a President Clinton phenomenon, but you know, in working with George W. Bush, I noticed this is not just a phenomenon that President Clinton had. George W. Bush had the same one. I remember talking to him and feeling the exact same way. And I remembered, I realized, you know what? These men who become leaders of the free world, you know, the largest democracy on the planet, you know, here are these men who've mastered the art of connection. And there's no coincidence that they were, in fact, leaders. They were presidents of the United States of America. And so in that moment, I realized and respected and placed much value on the art of connecting with people is far more important than networking with people. Networking is quick. It's zippy. It's, hey, who are you? What do you do? Give me your card. And it's without very much intention. It's almost like I'm in a rush to get to the next person, or I'm in a rush to get to do you or are you of any value to me? And for those who are listening to this call, I'm pretty sure that you've been at events where you've networked, where you've collected many, many cards, and you've shaken many, many hands, and very little's come out of it. Why? Because you didn't create a meaningful connection with one or two people. You networked with dozens because what you're quick to do and anxious to get done is monetizing the opportunity by being there and connecting with as many people as possible by way of shaking hands. That's not connecting. Connecting is having a moment with a person you don't know and having a conversation where when you leave, you never forget that conversation. It's almost like watching an incredible movie. An incredible movie was well written and well produced because you've never forgotten the character. You never have forgotten the theme, and perhaps even the remnants of the emotionality and response you have about that movie, whether it was a tragedy or a romance or an action film, whatever it was, still moves you to this day when you think about it. That is what connection does. Connection moves people. And if you're raising money or trying to attract investors, people are drawn to those who move, touch and inspire them. Rates of return and rates of investment is not what's important. Roy Rogers said it best. People aren't important. They're not concerned about the, you know, the return on their money. They're more concerned about the return of their money. And that comes from a really trustworthy person, and that's the person you need to become. And not by networking, but through connecting.
Wow. Wow. So key thing is connecting and also making that first connection, but moving on from that is the follow-up. You connect with people, and you're also a master of the follow-up. Do you have any, how do you follow up so effectively with people?
Well, you know, that's a tough question because you're probably hitting on a nerve that is very sensitive to me because of the fact of the velocity and the speed and just the vast reach that I'm creating for myself and my partners and for the various initiatives that we have. We actually are likely beginning to be ineffective, if not just weak at that. Because, you know, you can, as Ted Turner say, bite off more than you can chew and just chew like hell. But sometimes it causes indigestion, I have to say. So, you know, you could end up doing that. And so the follow-up is important. I'm glad you brought it up. You know, my effectiveness in following up is about making sure that you circle back with people you promise you are going to. But the challenge that I find that we all step into, and even I am doing this as well, is where you can't promise to follow up with everybody. And so you've got to prioritize. You've got to write that down. Prioritize. And prioritizing who you'll follow up with is all about getting very, very clear with why are you following up with somebody. You know, I'm starting to put that into practice. So, for example, I met with a gentleman just yesterday who I spoke with many weeks ago who said, hey, I'd like to work with you. I said, hey, you know, I like you. I would like to work with you too. And so when we sat down, we started chatting. He goes, okay, what would you like me to do? And the truth of the matter was I don't know what I want him to do. So I had to be honest about it. I had to say, look, I don't know what I want you to do. All I know is I like you. So when I have that figured out, let's talk to each other. So in the meantime, let's just date. Let's just, you know, when we can see each other, we'll chat. If we can have a coffee, we'll do that. If you want to keep researching the things that we're doing, wonderful. And if you can send me anything to learn about more about you, then wonderful. But being brutally honest isn't about letting go of that lead or that contact. But being brutally honest is being respectful of someone's time and their attention and their abilities. So following up is about making sure that at the very least you make a list of the people that you are and are holding very near and dear to your heart or to your mandate and circling back with them on a regular basis. And I would typically use Monday as that day. That way when you touch them on the Monday, you've got the rest of the week to take action with them. Otherwise, you've got to use a contact management software. I use Salesforce, which is important for me and my team. And more importantly, I actually have a very old-fashioned style. Do you know what it is, Russ? You'll never believe it. You probably can't guess.
I write it down on a piece of paper.
Oh, getting close. I really actually stick to the business cards. Mm. You know, the business card that people give you is a very old-fashioned but very useful way of saying, hey, if I'm holding on to that business card still and it's in my pocket or in my briefcase and it's got a rubber band around it, or sometimes if I have lots of them, they're in a Ziploc bag, those are people I've got to still circle back with and have a meaningful conversation with. So if that bag is full or if I've got a very thick stack of cards, either I've been really busy or I've been behind. So the business cards are a real great physical reminder of people I've got to circle back with and have a conversation to.
Wow, incredible. Mm-hmm. Incredible stuff. So I understand you're going to be showing us a detailed blueprint of how you present and how you have presentation success at the Raising Capital event on June 16th. What else are you going to be presenting at that, and what insights can somebody get, and why should somebody attend that event and listen to you?
Well, I think the event on June 16th for Raising Capital is going to be a great expansion. My presentation will be a great expansion from what we've discussed today. You know, I know you've hit on a number of the fine points that really make up the entire presentation that we've built for everyone in attendance on the Raising Capital event on June 16th. But I think the reason why this is a one-time only event is that because very rare have I been asked to really sort of sit still and distill the actual magic and power of what I've done and what I continue to do to this day. And I don't like doing that too often only because, A, it's a lot of work. B, it's my own competitive immunity. And C, it's my own magic sauce. So, you know, it's only because Russ, you, and Don, and Patrick, and the team has asked me to do that, that our team has actually stopped and said, you know what, let's do that. Let's do that to celebrate the 20th anniversary for RAIN. Let's do that because it seems like it's the right thing to do. But more importantly, let's do because I think the RAIN members who are going to attend are ready for it. There's no point in us teaching someone something on how to be successful at it if they're not willing to show up as the student willing to implement it. But we know that a lot of people actually are, more now than ever before. So I know we'll touch on personal presentation styles, which is not about, you know, how to speak, but how to present your deal, how to, in fact, put the right blueprint in place to actually speak into the values of those you're speaking to, and how to really create coin phraseology, what we call chunking it down, how to break down and compartmentalize your deal in such a way that it's easy for people to digest, to explore, to consider, to perform on a whim due diligence, and most of all, make a decision. Because at the end of the day, if people aren't acting because of you, well, they're going to act eventually in spite of you. And that's exactly what we're going to end up talking about on June 16th.
So if I heard you correctly, you're offering us patented insider secrets of
who
you are?
Patent pending, Russ.
Patent pending. The secret sauce of how to present.
Yeah.
I like that as a title.
TM, there you go, TM. The secret sauce, though.
Love it. So if someone's on this call, obviously the best place to get a hold of you will come out live to June 16th, the Raising Capital event. What would be a good place to get a hold of you if someone has a question or they'd like to follow up and maybe open up a dialogue or a connection with you? Where would be a good place to find you?
Well, absolutely. What you can all do is you can write me, Richard, R-I-C-H-A-R-D, at raincanada.com, and I'll be more than happy to respond to your emails. Be patient with me if there is a delay of any kind. I do have a team that supports me on that, so in case it's urgent, by all means, say so. But I can promise you this, that no email goes unreturned.
Wow. And Richard will be one of the experts at the upcoming Raising Capital event in Ontario on June 16th. Are you prepared to answer questions if people bring their questions with them to this event, Rich?
Absolutely. And I think what's really important is that everyone understands that on that particular day, and unlike any other, and that's why it's going to be for a one-time only, that after we present the presentation, I will be available for comments and suggestions, some insights. And I know that some members and their guests have even asked in advance, well, if I brought you my particular case, would you actually review it and take a look? And we are more than happy to do that, because I'm coming with my team, who will be sitting at the event, who collectively will in fact help and assist to make sure that that day is not just a learning experience, but a result-rich experience. So you get what you came for by the time you leave. So it's going to be definitely a day of action.
Wow. And that event, if you're interested in attending, which all real estate investors, it's absolutely mandatory attendance. It's happening June 16th, the International Center out by the Pearson International Airport. And it's fully designed to eliminate the biggest hurdle you will encounter in real estate, and that's finding the capital. If you'd like more information or to instantly register, you can call our office at 1-888-824-7346 or just follow the registration link on this page where you're listening to this audio interview. Wow, Rich, I really know how busy you are and how crazy your day was today. So for you to take time out today, it's greatly appreciated, especially playing full out like you always do. Do you have any final last words for people listening to this interview?
Well, listen, Russ, I really do appreciate you acknowledging how busy I am, and I know a lot of people who know who I am on this phone call listening to this particular message and or recording, however you want to describe it, know who I am. The reality is this, is that I think it's time that people really get out of their own way to really absorb and learn the lessons of those who are really blazing the trail and producing results, producing progress. And so for me to really step up and sort of put all my chips and be all in, if it were, for that particular day, is a huge testament to just the stand that we take with Don and the RAIN team on really elevating the conditions of your satisfaction to a new height. Enough of mediocrity, enough of just linear growth. It's time for exponential results. It's time to really play full out and do what you know you need to do. And so we know that learning the ins and outs, the secrets, the insights, taking the 20 years that I've been in this business and really distilling them for yourself, you know, there's no better time to do it than now. Because at the end of the day, all you have is these opportunities to really take people's expertise, like mine and the accountants and the lawyers and all the others who are on that day, and really make it your own. So at the end of the day, it's not that you have a page full of notes, but you actually have an action plan for yourself. So I'll look forward to seeing you, and I do appreciate and thank you all for listening to the interview. I hope to see you there.
Well, as I did mention at the beginning, Rich is going to challenge you to think bigger. I think this is a fantastic place to leave off. I'm Russell Westcott from the Real Estate Investment Network, your one-stop shop for all things investment real estate. Signing off and looking forward to seeing everyone at a RAIN event very soon. Bye for now.